Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Marianne Wiggins, the author most recently of Evidence of Things Unseen, which has been published in paperback recently by Simon & Schuster, who also published the hardback edition. Other books which are in print and paperback include Almost Heaven and John Dollar. Now, what I've noticed, thrillingly, are you working on an American epic?
Gosh, am I? I didn't know I was working on an epic to begin with. And it's got to be American. Sure, everything about me, the way I speak, the way I talk, the way I move, my optimism, my outlook, I'm definitely American. So if I hadn't been, Michael, it starts now.
Well, what I noticed was I reread Almost Heaven, the previous novel, before I read Evidence of Things Unseen, and they seem to be novels on American themes. They share, among other things, comments on rivers and how they shape the lives around them. Evidence of Things Unseen is a novel that takes place in America between World War I and World War II. Almost Heaven is more or less a contemporary novel, but both of them seem to be about how to live in a country in which upheaval is constant, progress relentless. Love Sought For is an American story form, and so there's a kind of tender seeking for an impossible love affair in Almost Heaven and a true love affair, really tender, in Evidence of Things Unseen. Then I went and looked at Eveless Eden, and there too I began to see this sense of a set of novels after John Dollar that are about how to live in a particular country, in a particular time, with a particular set of travails.
Writing, like reading, is a process of excavation. I don't always know where I'm going until I get there. Now I'm getting older in it. I've been writing now for 3 decades, so I kind of know what I'm doing. And this country is my subject matter. I'm the granddaughter of immigrants. I have a real old-fashioned view of the optimism and the hope that lives here, particularly after 16 years in England, which is so class-conscious and has so many repressed feelings of hope. Hope isn't in the air there. Hope really has to be sort of purchased in England in a way that it's not here. So, yes, I think, you know, my country is my subject matter. And because I write, I tend to write on a larger political canvas than you know, so sort of a kitchen novel would. And I love it, and I love being an American. So perhaps that's what shows.
Well, Ray and Opal at the beginning, like Ray Jr. and Pearl at the end, they meet in a kind of magical way. They know immediately. They seem destined for one another. Opal reads dime store novels. Ray believes in radiance, witness both his name and his interest in bioluminescence. Orioles and all kinds of haloed events seem to promise both the optimism of the novel as well as the terror. We're going to find out that things like X-rays and other kinds of rays are as destructive as they are romantic. In fact, I'd say that's how these novels work. They shift in poles from the beautiful, the luminescent, and the poetic to the actual and fearful ways in which the things we've been romanticizing have crept into our lives and altered them.
I hope that that mirrors the way life is. I mean, there is no hermetic, except within a gothic novel or, you know, a genre novel. I mean, you sort of know that you're living in a closed box, but we don't live in closed boxes. At least I haven't opened myself to the, you know, to that closedness. It's not what I seek. And so there's always the shadow other, a yin and yang sort of. There's no determination without doubt, for example, and it's the doubt that gives it its dimension. There's no love without the fear of loss of love, and that's what gives it its beauty. And I try to reflect that in what I write.
Now, Opal and Ray seem to be made for each other, and a man who only briefly connects with his love and is very destructive to it says that they were truly in love. This book seems to me to be interested in defining that state. It spends around nearly three-quarters of its length spinning that love and that acceptance into a palpable form, locating it at an American time, giving its two lovers a real intimacy despite their childlessness, so much so that a found baby becomes almost a reward for their love. You know, you've been rooting for them so much. And the series of letters that the child receives has been carefully edited by one letter in which his own appearance is described because his parents have never told him where he came from. He's really, you know, you understand in the last 30 pages of the book that the whole book answers this boy's quest. You know, the book has been telling the boy, yes, your father worked on the atomic bomb, but paradoxically, it was his X-ray machine that dazzled people at county fairs by showing the bones in their feet that probably created the death of the woman he loved. It's such an interesting way of proceeding with a novel because fatedness is constantly being interrupted in it.
I hope that is true to the way we live our lives. And I was teaching at NYU in the master's program, and it was during a period of time when my whole life was under a lot of chaos. I was married to Salman Rushdie at the time, and we had separated, and I wasn't writing because of the fatwa with him, and so I was teaching. I didn't live in New York permanently. I had come over from London, and I was really not writing very well because so much was going on in my life. And one of my students said to me, "You need to write love stories." And because he had read John Dollar and he had read my short stories, and I thought, well, he's right. There's not a lot of people who can write about love. And I think at a certain point in a writer's career, you sort of say, all right, well, I'll make the debit and the plus, you know, columns. And what is it that I do and what is it that I don't really do very well? And I can do that. That's part of my gift. I get love. Maybe not in my personal life, but I get it on the page. And spending one's life writing love stories is not a bad thing to do, mixed with the political and et cetera. It's what I can understand, and perhaps it's my own yearning, and the reason that, you know, to some extent I have found love through this. It gives me back as much as I give to the reader, I hope. And it is idealized, but yet it has the fatal aspects to it.
I'm speaking to Marianne Wiggins, the author most recently of Evidence of Things Unseen. which has just been published in its paperback edition by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now, we have a man, Ray, a would-be scientist, who's trying to determine whether the fireflies are storing moonlight and releasing it again, and therefore his room is full of the corpses of fireflies. You know, it's the warning of what science may be about to do, and he is the most optimistic of scientists. In fact, Opal tells him, out of her passionate lack of knowledge but support, that his science is wrong, you know, that he doesn't really know what science is. But there is the sense of a world in which the world of science is dawning, and it seems to be the counter to the romantic idyll these characters make for themselves.
It also reflects, I think, and let's not confuse science with technology, because we live in a highly technological world right now. But the science is still there, and it's there in a pure way. Unfortunately, it gets into economics, and you know, the great funding aspects of science now are toward a commercial application. Leaving that aside, the lab work of science is Pandora's box. It's this opening of this wonder. There's a lot of physics in Evidence of Things Unseen because it is about the building of the atomic bomb. And so I had to teach myself. I never took science courses in high school. I took two languages instead. And so I went through this sort of opening of windows of the mind that my hero, Ray Foster, goes through, and fell in love with, gosh, the first law of thermodynamic, you know, just wow. There's an order and there's a sense of almost calm that comes in seeing how the world works and seeing that although I don't define God as such, because I'm still battling with that sense on a personal level, that there is an intense beauty and almost brings you to your knees when you start to look at things in a microscope and see how life is built and how it functions. And that's what Ray feels. And his science is as flawed as my science. I mean, I couldn't build an atomic bomb. You know, I don't really understand physics. And so I was able to find, if I was going to write a book about physics, then I had to find someone who would contain all my flawed understanding of it. And he does.
The book takes place largely in the South, and you were born, I believe, in Pennsylvania.
I was.
And it feels like someone has said, a love letter. But I don't think it's so much a love letter as that your imagination, I think largely unconsciously, is structured along the line of oppositions, so that you mention, maybe it's in Almost Heaven, that in order to understand Americans, Europeans would have to understand the war they least understand, the Civil War, and that it's about believing in a thing and its opposite simultaneously, so that you're intimate with both yourself and your opposite, in a sense. That's what happens during the Scope trial. The romance of the South meets the romance of the scientist, and we're watching, this is the testing ground, in a sense, of Evidence of Things Unseen. How do we both love a world that's going to protect itself from change at the same time as we love change, which may in turn throw our world into violent upheaval? This is where the romance of the book is situated. It wants permanence, but knows that permanence is inflexibility. It wants progress, but knows that progress is upheaval. It seems like a book about inching forward.
Inching forward and inching backwards. Part of that oppositional force, I think part of it is being a woman, in this society, and knowing and not to blow my own horn, but a pretty smart woman. It's not easy being a smart woman because brains are not necessarily that part of a woman that is best loved by American society, nor any current society. So part of that was formed in my, you know, the fact that I am a woman. I write, I see, I walk through life very much as a woman, and always having to dissemble a little bit, and you know, not to be too pushy or not to be too aggressive, which is another slap in the face to women who really are only speaking their minds. Part of it is that. Part of it is also that my father was from Pennsylvania, but my mother was from Virginia. And there was very much a sense of the Mason-Dixon line was this evidence of things unseen. I mean, it's not a little wall that you walk over, and it's, it never was built as such, but it was a very clear defining boundary.
Wow, that makes so much sense to me.
And my father also was a fundamentalist Christian, really, truly did not permit me to read Darwin. I mean, there was no reading of evolution in my father's world. A man whom I deeply loved, you know, understand, but there was a limit to what he would tolerate, that too much questioned his God. My mother was Greek Orthodox. So one Sunday I would go to the, you know, the pine pews with the hard backs, and the next I would go to the, you know, liturgy with men dressed like women, when, you know, in silk robes with incense floating through the air. So there was always an oppositional sense, which I think has been my saving grace, Michael, because it has allowed a spirited empathy to develop, which is the foundation of all peacemaking. If you cannot know who your enemy is, you're never going to make peace. And so I think it really has saved me. It's opened me to vast experiences with the others, all the others in the world, as opposed to living in that tiny little box that I talked about before.
Well, it fascinated me because, you know, I go and gather all the books, and I went and got, is it Driving South? Is that
Went South.
Excuse me?
Went South.
Went South. And the subtitle, at least on the cover of its original edition, was A Woman's Novel.
Oh, God, that goes back. Well, it was published during the 70s, and so, you know, yes, they had to say it was a woman's book because, you know, as opposed to just a book.
Uh-huh. But it's interesting to me because Evidence of Things Unseen might have, as its enunciatory gesture, it does not, a love story, because at this time, the idea of, I mean, a love story of the sort that suggests that there's a music of the spheres.
Yeah, could have a tagline, a love story for everyone.
Yes.
Not just, you know, not mm-hmm. just a woman's love, a love story for men.
but you see, I think that the boldness with which these books begin, John Dollar, A Lord of the Flies for Women, you know, the way people categorize or reshape, the books begin with a statement and then immediately set about weaving a lovely contradiction to the statement, so that everything that you expect, I think, just as we're reaching the final pages and we say, oh, she's bringing back that old man who whittled the whales. Yes, she is. But lo and behold, he's deaf, he's mute, he can't see, and he can't give the character any of the information he seeks. So we have this enormous romantic impulse to do the fated things where prophets and artists recur, but they don't bring answers with them.
They don't bring what you thought they were going to bring. I was surprised also that I do have this tendency to have characters disappear halfway through my work to reappear. I mean, in John Dollar, it opens with a female character who you think it's going to be her story. And then, lo and behold, at about page 50 or so, I just have her disappear, only to reappear at the end. And I was stunned because this was an unconscious. I didn't realize I was doing this, nor because I didn't. I have no practical training as a writer except as a reader. I have not gone to college. I married directly out of high school. So I didn't realize that I was breaking this fundamental rule that when you introduce a main character, you do not have that character disappear halfway through the book, only to perhaps reappear at the end. I didn't realize the risks that I was taking. And I think this also might possibly be an emotional response, an unconscious emotional response on my part, because my father was a suicide and disappeared. No clues were dropped. This was just happened, and happened in my 20s. And I realized that I have that emotional reflex of this anticipation somehow of something disappearing. And then, you know, I may be countering the ability to bring it back. This may be this lost hope on my part.
There's a real openness to the barrier between life and death in these books. People die, but they leave boxes of clues behind and memories. These characters are so resonant that the young Ray at the end of the book is hearing the same echoes we've been hearing throughout the book. He is someone who's been introduced to a world of significance that it's his life's quest to recover. And it's very moving to me to hear you say that the opposition between your parents and their tenuous presence to you, it seems like only you could have written this book.
An attitude, well, I'm not suggesting that all writers reflect their childhoods or their life experiences. And I don't do so consciously. I don't write out of the material of my life, so to speak. And I've never written a book that takes place in Pennsylvania, for example. But clearly, my life is my text. I don't want to show you the details of my life in my work. I mean, then it would not be it wouldn't be literature. It would be a telephone book. But I remember now that in you forming your last question to me, I got a very clear image of a memory of riding in the back seat of an armored Scotland Yard car during months just right after succeeding the Salman going into protection with Scotland Yard. And the windows were tinted, and we were in the back seat, and we were stuck in traffic in the middle of London. And there was all that world going on, and everyone in that city wondering, where is Salman Rushdie? What is he doing? And we were sitting right there and watching everything move around and sort of being in the world but not in the world. It was a very, very strange experience. And I realized that individuals who, let's say, are undiagnosed depressed or carrying around a grief or an overwhelming life problem, a disease, have that same feeling of disconnectedness in the world. And that to make the connection through the tinted window or through the, you know, through the political necessities of Great Britain versus Iran, you know, something to reach out to somehow show both sides of that was something that perhaps those earlier experiences in my life had given me the skills to do, but it was brought home on that instant that, oh my God, I'm sitting inside an experience that probably everyone has had at one time or another. You don't have to be protected by Scotland Yard to be cut off from the world. And that I should find this some way to relate to this experience. And perhaps in structuring my books and informing the plot points, surely this has been a motivating influence.
This is a novel, Evidence of Things Unseen, of homecoming. And it's a really embraced American novel, Rivers and everything else about it. You know, we've got the whole fishing and American landscape, and both coasts are going to be travailed. Was this resettling in America? You've been here for 4 years now. This is your longest novel. It probably took the longest to write. Was this a re-embrace of American identity?
Well, it took my life to write. I think it was the book that, after 16 years in England, I think that exile shaped my love for, you know, what it means to be an American. And let's face it, I had an experience in Great Britain unlike any other American. And, you know, I came to realize that living in a society which fundamentally has no Bill of Rights, the English do not have a Bill of Rights where your rights are actually spelled out on an individual piece of paper. They follow legal precedent as the creation of. So if there is a precedent, but that means that if it hasn't been tried in the courts, it doesn't exist as a precedent. So your rights are not guaranteed. They're always being sort of shaped as you go along. And particularly in the 80s, I thought, oh, God bless the United States. I miss it so much, you know. So I've come back as sort of reshaped and reborn as sort of Sid Arthur, you know, and sort of come back to these shores. And where? In the West. I'm not a Western girl. And now I'm living out here. And I wake up to wonder every morning. In fact, I went back to London last March. And I took the train over from Paris, and I got out at Waterloo Station, and I thought I was in some sort of theme park. All the scale had diminished. There wasn't the great open sky that I'm now used to seeing here in California. And so now all my references are, I'm writing, the new novel takes place in the West. I'm now given up the, you know, my Southern roots, and I'm writing a Western novel. It's not a Western, but it takes place in California and Arizona. And I think this is, I've just been sort of reborn into, which is great. It's a great feeling at the end of my 50s to find out, you know, not only have I got my authorial voice, I'm not, you know, hitting my head against the wall about who is it and what should I be writing, but I've got my place. And it just feels wonderful.
I've been talking with Marianne Wiggins, author most recently of Evidence of Things Unseen. Thank you, Marianne, for joining
me.
It's been a pleasure. You can read an excerpt from Evidence of Things Unseen on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.